It's Thursday, September 21st, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from McAlester, Oklahoma. Good evening, and welcome to the first of what I plan to be two podcasts from today. And this first one really is just a series of reflections on some things that I've been thinking about over the past week and a half or so. As you may know from a posting or two on my blog, I have been in a series of workshops, or actually presenting, I guess, a series of seminars on the E-rate process for getting federal funding for telecommunications and internet services and wiring that U.S. schools can apply to obtain, and also sharing a presentation about free digital curriculum with educators around the state of Oklahoma. And this audience has been a mixed bag of technology directors, some principals, but more often assistant superintendents or the actual superintendent of the school district. And what I'd like to do today is just reflect a little bit about really a podcast that I listened to today as I was driving about 250 miles in total between several Oklahoma towns, and then talk a little bit about how that relates in my mind to teaching and learning and this idea of changing education and reforming education, even when the culture in which we find ourselves is often very resistant to that idea of change. One of the things I really am enjoying about my job here in the state of Oklahoma as the state advocate for education for AT&T is that I get to do a fair amount of driving around the state, and that gives me an opportunity to listen to podcasts and do some thinking and listen to music and really sort of disengage my brain a little bit from what I might normally do if I was in an office sitting in front of a computer or teaching a workshop or doing something else. So today, one of the podcasts I listened to was from one of my favorite channels, the University of Virginia's podcast and webcast channel, which I'll link in the podcast show notes. And this podcast from September 16th, 2006 was called More Than the Score, The Physics of Football. And University of Virginia physics professor Lou Bloomfield really sort of gave an overview of some of the basic laws of motion as they apply to sports and specifically football. And several of the things that he talked about were really pretty worth remembering, I guess, and so I took a few notes. I've had a bit of physics in my background and took a year of physics in high school, and I guess I learned enough physics to really sort of almost do myself an in-service, because at the time I went to college and took a entrance exam to figure out where I needed to be placed, I knew enough physics to get into the 1 year of physics in a semester course. And so it was really an accelerated physics course, and I honestly didn't do very well in it. But I love physics, I love science, and I've known the difference, I thought, between mass and weight. You know, because mass was, my idea was, that was the matter, the atomic matter inside something, and weight was the mass multiplied by the force of gravity. So, you know, when you're in space where there is no gravity, you still have mass, but you're weightless. Well, in this particular podcast, where mass, inertia, and other things relating to the laws of motion were discussed, Dr. Bloomfield said that mass is how hard something is to shake. And I thought that was really interesting, because that's not typically how I think of mass. And if you think about, as he talked and discussed, the reasons why linebackers and centers, tackles, guards, the large players that make up the offensive or defensive line on a football team are so difficult to move and are able to do an effective job, it's really because they have a lot of mass. They're hard to shake, they're hard to move, and they're hard to transfer momentum to, and when they get a lot of momentum going, they certainly pack a big a big punch. One of the other comments that Dr. Bloomfield made was that as human beings, a lot of times, we go through life trying to avoid momentum transfers. I thought that was pretty funny. And what he was talking about was that when you're an object in motion, which we typically are a lot of times when we're not sleeping in our beds, we have inertia, and that's just a force that we are encouraged to continue moving or coasting at the same speed and the same direction that we are going in. And if we're going to make a change, be that a directional change or we're actually going to stop moving entirely, we don't want that to happen all of a sudden. We don't want to run into a wall. We don't want to run into a tree. You know, we want to gradually slow down. And so I thought that had some real interesting parallels to the educational environment, because we certainly see a lot of resistance to change, a lot of inertia, and possibly an argument could be made, a lot of people, either teachers or administrators or even parents, who seem to be going through life trying to avoid momentum transfers or disruptive changes. And I've talked about that issue of disruptive technology several times before in the podcast. So that sort of thinking about inertia and momentum sort of colored my thinking today as I was considering some ideas about school reform and school change, and really the messages that I have received, which have been mixed, understandably, I guess, from some of the audiences that I have been talking to as I have been in the midst of this seminar series in the state of Oklahoma. One of the things you may have heard me talk about before is something called the failure bow. And as I have worked with teachers and students, it's one of my favorite things to basically teach people. And what it does is it really exemplifies the idea that when we fail, we need to celebrate that if we can learn from it and then walk away from it and not let failure define us. And it's something that I learned from a lady who was working with a group of educators at a San Jose, California Apple Distinguished Educators event, I think last summer. And she does improvisation and works with Pixar animators, among others. They're very creative people. And anyway, it's been interesting as I've done this series of workshops, as I said, with a mixed audience, that when I have shared that with people, it's been received in very different ways. This has reinforced several things to me, and one of those is this idea of the classroom being such a dynamical environment. And what that means to me in terms of being dynamical is that there are just a lot of feedback loops that are always happening in between the learners in the room, whether it be the teacher who is in front or students who may be seated, you know, in desks or tables or whatever in front of the teacher, usually are often looking at the teacher. And what I've observed is that it is amazing how different the just environment and the almost atmosphere is when there's a positive sense of feedback, a positive vibe coming from the students, from the audience to the speaker. And, you know, the contrary is also true, that when the audience is really not in and into and responding to the message, you know, I really feel that as a presenter. And so I have taken some risks. One of the things I believe is that in order to utilize educational technology in the classroom, a teacher needs to be willing to embrace some risk because, you know, there's a lot of unknowns when we use technology. And so probably about a month and a half ago, I was down in Houston at a Catholic diocese teaching about 10 or 12 Catholic priests how to use video conferencing equipment, who are going to start utilizing it in their seminary and in the course of instruction. And, you know, that was a kind of an intimidating audience, and I didn't know if this was going to fly or not, but it really went off pretty well. And I think they appreciated this idea of being able to laugh, celebrate, and be a little lighthearted about the mistakes that we might make with technology. Anyway, one of the sessions that I gave here in Oklahoma in the last week and a half, generally that's been received pretty well, but in one case it really wasn't. And I mean, it was like pulling teeth to get these administrators to, you know, put their hands over their head and woohoo, celebrate. you know, this idea of failure. And so, anyway, after that particular session where the feedback just, the vibe wasn't as good, one of the administrators came up to me and commented that, you know, some of these ideas that I was sharing about digital curriculum really, you know, sounded great, but they just didn't have any time to do that with students in the classroom, because they only had, I think he said 172 instructional days. They were in the course of working with teachers on their curriculum pacing guide and, you know, really bearing down on teaching just every single minute. And my comment to him at that time was that I didn't know if this was true or not, if this was, you know, this was what was the answer. But I thought that we were probably placing too much faith today in curriculum. He made another comment to me that if I could come up with writing a curriculum that tied a lot of these ideas right directly into the state standards for Oklahoma, you know, I could be a millionaire. And my comment again was that I think our faith is misplaced if it's in the curriculum. What we really need to place our faith in are in the teachers that we have in our classrooms. Well, there were several other thoughts that I had about this subsequently as I was driving across the beautiful state of Oklahoma today. And in light of listening to that podcast about inertia and momentum and resistance to change, I guess there were really four different responses that I thought of having. And one of them really was being really frustrated and sort of losing heart at this idea of striving to help change education and reform education. I wrote a blog post in the last week that I titled something like, I have found my fight, or I have found my battle, I think. And concluded with this idea of saddling up, because we have a struggle to engage in terms of helping reform education. And, you know, sometimes life can just sort of knock you down and bring you down from whatever cloud you happen to be on. And some of my experiences in the last week and a half have been a little bit like that. And that's a good thing. You know, it's good to maintain humility and not, lose your perspective on the world. But, you know, it's also, I think, indicative of the fact that we don't need, or I don't personally, need to focus too much on a big picture when it comes to change. Rather than being depressed or being frustrated with the obstacles that seem insurmountable when we look at the big picture, I think what I need to do and want to encourage others to do as well is really to focus on the sphere and the small environment, perhaps, just the context in which I find myself and you find yourself. You know, to change one life is to have succeeded. I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson who has a quotation and said something to that effect, or wrote that. So anyway, that's the first response. The second response that I've had to this, I guess, really is tied into that, and that is to change my focus and think about just working with individual teachers. That's a wonderful thing about my job as the education advocate, is I have a chance to, you know, work with groups of teachers, but also work one-on-one with teachers. And oftentimes I find that to be the most rewarding thing, because that's really where a lot of learning takes place. I mean, we can do all kinds of workshops and things, but, you know, working with an individual teacher, you know, if you think about it as holding hands with technology use, that is what often needs to happen in order for a teacher to learn some new skills and get comfortable using, in this case, some new technology. So my second response, I guess, is to really just refocus and think about, you know, the small differences and the small changes that can be made. But those are real impactful changes, potentially, because, you know, they may actually change the teaching practice and the instructional opportunities and invitations that a teacher shares with students throughout the day. The third response is really one of, I guess, impassioned anger. And this isn't something that I said to this administrator who had talked to me, because it's not his fault that we have all of these requirements and all of these mandates. If we think about it, we've really had a series of events happen over the past probably 10 to 15 years in the United States educational system. We've had legislators who have continued to put more mandates on schools, but we've also had educators involved in the standards movement who, I think, really at the bottom of all of it, have not trusted teachers to teach well. And so by specifying all these standards, they have hoped that they will be able to improve the educational experience and therefore the educational outcomes for students. I almost, you know, considered doing a podcast tonight and titling it Get Out of My Classroom. And rather than addressing the traditional audience, which I think is mostly, you know, teachers and administrators and, you know, possibly some students who may be in pre-service education programs, others that are involved in the educational process, specifically addressing this to legislators who are the ones passing some of these mandates and saying to those legislators, stop damaging the educational opportunity that we see happening in so many schools and so many classrooms. I mean, it really is a crime that we're in a place today where so many teachers and so many administrators feel like they don't have time to do project-based learning. They don't have time to invite students to explore a new tool like Google Earth and make connections in between, you know, the lesson that they may be doing on a country in the world, and, you know, other kinds of information that they may find on the internet or, you know, in different places about it. It's just a very frustrating thing. So that's the third response. But the last and fourth response, which may be the most reasoned response, is one that reminds me of my grandmother. I had actually moved to Lubbock, Texas in 1993 because my grandmother was living there, and I had an opportunity in the Air Force to basically select which base that I wanted to go to. And Lubbock was my first choice. And when I hung out with my grandmother, one of the things I could always count on from her was, I guess, a real perspective on issues. And whatever the crisis of the day was and whatever the struggle was, I think she was always able to help me see that, you know, this too shall pass and an opportunity will come to either work around this issue or, you know, solve this issue, deal with this problem. And it was just really a voice of wisdom. I really enjoy hanging out with older people for that reason. I really miss my grandmother. I don't have any living grandparents anymore, but I do have opportunities, to hang out and visit with people that just have a lot more life experience. And so what this sort of says to me, as I think about this, is, you know, change is coming on the educational landscape. And even though we see a great deal of inertia and a great deal of momentum avoidance in the educational context, I think that the changes we're seeing in our culture and in our economy, and a lot of that has to do with technology, really are going to bring about some changes in schools. And it's just frustrating oftentimes to see those changes being so slow, but maybe that happens more often when we have a big picture focus rather than sort of a micro focus or a focus just on the smaller scale. So I'd like to conclude with a final quotation, and I'm not actually at this point a registered Democrat, but I have been listening to podcasts by several Democrats lately. One of the great ones I listened to this last week was by the former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And yesterday I listened to one from Geraldine Ferraro, who, as you may remember, depending on your age, was the Democratic candidate for vice president in 1984 and the only woman to date who has run for that high of an elective office in the United States. And she actually shared a quotation by Robert Kennedy that I thought was very apropos to this topic. And Kennedy said, "If there's no one standing in your way, you're probably not going anywhere." I thought that really did have some applicability to the educational context as well. So with that, I will bid you adieu and encourage you, as always, to provide any feedback on the blog. Visit my website at www.westfryer.com and click the contact link. Or, if you are so inclined and have the time, in the iTunes Music Store, you can click on the podcast directory and search for Speed of Creativity, and you'll be able to find the podcast there and leave any feedback or comments that you may want to. So, until next time, this is Wesley Fryer, podcasting from McAllister, Oklahoma, wishing you good night and good luck. Moving.
Speaking of the Speed of Creativity podcasts are independently produced and syndicated for a global audience by Wesley Fryer and are shared under a Creative Commons Attribution 2.5 license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.